Right, well, the way this usually goes is that I waffle for about 10 minutes and then my poor guest gets a chance to get a word in edgewise. So that's the system we've set up. I'm John Atack, for those who don't know. And this is my wonderful friend Hoyt Richards. Hi, Hoyt.
Good to see you, John, as always. How have you been?
Pretty good actually, yeah, for the most part. How about you?
I can't complain. It's a little overcast here in LA, but it's summer is finally around the corner. I mean, we've had like a 5 month winter here, from LA standards. So I'm ready for the sun.
I remember being there in January once and it rained. People were in such shock, you know, it's raining.
We've actually had more rain than Seattle this year.
Whoa.
Yeah. So I don't
That
know. Where's the
is very
global
difficult. That's quite
warming when you need it, right? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, it's terrible. Well, you're having a shift in the rivers in the air, aren't you? But
Yeah.
because of the Amazon rainforest, because of Bolsonaro, and we're hearing now that Luna is going to do the same thing
Oh,
after
really?
all the promises about stopping the logging there. So, you know, anybody that's watching, thinkchange.org have a petition where an indigenous woman from the Amazon is saying, we're trying to protect this forest. And this guy has come in with all of these promises. And the problem is that it will change the rivers in the air, which bring the rain to the United States.
Oh,
And
really?
you'll quite likely get a dust bowl effect if nothing's done about it. Don't want to sound too alarmist here, but you know,
Wow.
rainforest quite important
I
apparently.
would say so.
And it means that, I mean, global warming will mean here, if the predictions are correct, and they seem to have worked out in the last 20 years, what was predicted has happened. You know, the melting of great melts of ice, particularly in Greenland. But we, of course, have the Gulf Stream over our south coast and up
Right, of
the
course.
west side, and we're told it will move. So while everywhere else is getting lovely and sunny or too hot to live in, it's going to get colder here. So,
Wow.
I think people
You know,
should.
England doesn't need to get colder, you know? I don't think that's very nice. Yeah.
Well, it's funny. I have a friend over from Australia who's moved here, and she was here at the weekend complaining about how hot it is. And it has been beautiful the last couple of weeks, but she's looking forward to the summer ending. And you're like, well, technically, it hasn't started yet, you know.
Oh,
And what we did, we had two terrible heat waves last year, just 2 or 3 days long. But my run of beans failed. And that's
wow.
never happened before. And my potatoes failed because
Yeah, and didn't you have a day that was like 40 degrees Celsius? That was a record.
we did. We managed to reach the
Yeah.
hottest temperature ever. We were 3 or 4 degrees below that, but it was still too hot. So
Yeah.
I think we should sack our politicians and get some politicians who can do something about the weather. You know,
Yeah.
change the weather for us, you know, go out and do rain dances or whatever is necessary. Get some proper politicians for change.
I'd like to see that. See some politicians doing a rain dance. That would be worth the price of admission
Yeah.
alone.
I mean,
Yeah.
I have various political ideas. I think that decimation, the old Roman thing that if a legion fails, you kill every 10th soldier. I think that would be quite good. That if the politicians, because, you know, the whole idea of the death penalty in prison is that it puts people off
Right.
growing up. And so if politicians, if it was like the end of every, you know, parliament or every senate, whoever had, you know, done the least work or voted wrong, if they were just kind of even, you know, let's be a bit milder, capital punishment's a bit severe, put them in the stocks
Yeah.
and
Well,
throw rotten tomatoes at them.
it's like the football league, right? You get demoted. If you're at the bottom of the league, you get sent down to the lower league, right? So you
Yeah,
don't pull
so
your weight. There's
they have to go and work
ramifications.
in social services for a year.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Do some actual
Exactly.
work for change. Oh dear. So I've come across this thing called which will lead into various and glorious pathways, no doubt, called Biderman's Chart of Coercion. And I'm a little bit shocked because I shouldn't admit this after 40 years working in this field. I've never seen this before.
Yeah, I've never heard of it either. Yeah.
I've n never seen it referred to in the literature. We talk about Lifton's eight deadly sins of thought reform, and quite rightly, they are
Exactly.
Quite remarkable lens on human behavior.
Yeah.
But this came out of the same period from the confusion arising about the Chinese thought reform program, which started pretty much in 1949 when 200,000 members of Mao's army were put through this program to teach them the proper class consciousness, which was that they had the wrong idea of things, that everything that was wrong in the world was the fault of the rich. Oh, well, there could be some truth in that, the super rich at least. But in his case, it was anybody that had anything. And that you then had to go through self-criticism, a process that was applied to you in the hot seat.
That's the modern
Western method of it. And then you had to do thought struggle, where basically you do harm to people who'd been labeled the enemies of the people, class enemies, class traitors. And so there were various things. And then the Korean War, that there was this idea that American airmen were confessing to crimes they hadn't committed. It gets a little confusing, because the man Biderman, who wrote this scale looking at how mind control, brainwashing, thought reform works, in 1963 published a book saying the confessions were true, that US airmen were dropping infected mosquitoes in cluster bomb units on North Korea. But that's another topic altogether, and we'll leave that tantalizing idea. There was an international report that supported the idea. But he gives us just 8 points. So I'm going to just read straight through them, and then we'll see if that rocks anybody's boat. So we have isolation, taking people away from what they're used to. I suppose Robert J. Lifton's milieu control is, you know, you isolate the person and put them in a group of people that disagree with them. Monopolization of perception. So your information is controlled. Induced debilitation and exhaustion. I wonder if we recognize this in cults. Threats. You know, if you leave, you'll be struck dead.
Oh, yes.
Occasional indulgences. Oh, here's a sweetie for you. You've been a good boy. Demonstrating omnipotence and omniscience. This is Lifton's mystical manipulation, where you know stuff about people because you've cheated. You've looked them up on Google or what have you. Degradation, pushing the person down so that they feel shamed and humiliated. And enforcing trivial demands. So that I'm just going to segue from there into... Wow. You were mentioning this book, Tribes, again, which we started in on when we last spoke. And I think it's time. This is terrible. I was looking for a video to send to somebody who I'm going to interview, this famous psychiatrist. And I looked through 20 videos and found that my videos largely consist exactly, as I say, of me waffling for 10 minutes and then poor guest getting a few words. So it's your turn now, Hoyt.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm really glad you mentioned some of those things about the hot seat. I don't know if you have watched this program that was on. I think it's on Hulu, so I don't know if you get it in the UK. But it's about this cultic group that happened around the Sarah Lawrence College.
Larry Ray.
Yeah, exactly.
I haven't seen it, but I've, many people around me have mentioned it.
I've got mixed feelings about it, in the sense that I think, again, the story was told, and this is a common complaint I have about how cults are handled in the media. The story's told too soon, so no one's really healed. So you're not getting anyone with any perspective on it, and you're not getting any kind of lessons learned or silver lining out of this horrible experience. You're just seeing carnage, which is, you know, leaves an audience feeling pretty disturbed and pretty hopeless as far as, you know, the people are concerned. And I think that's not realistic necessarily to how people surviving something like this ultimately end up in a place that can be quite empowering and quite, you know, you know, solid. So
I'm very glad of my cult experience, but then I was very lucky compared to most people.
Yeah.
I am a thriving survivor, and I know you are too.
Yeah, exactly. So I always have complaints in that area, but the place that I thought was such a strength about the Larry Ray thing is he was He was such a narcissist and such an egomaniac that he filmed everything he did. Not everything, but a huge amount. So I've for years have tried to relay to others what that hot seat was like. And you get to witness it in this program. And so it's called Stolen Youth, and it's on Hulu. And so there's scenes that he actually films where you actually watch him, for lack of a better term, mind fucking people, you know, really kind of put them on the hot seat and then asking them questions where they feel like there's an event that happened that he's asking them to come clean about that they don't remember doing because they actually didn't do it. And they have to come up with a scenario of how they did do this just to get it to stop. Yeah. And that's very relatable to certain things I went through. And you just see these kids that are just being spun these horrible webs around to where they get to the point where they don't think they can even trust their own thoughts because they're having to take on responsibility for acts they didn't even commit. And that paints a certain kind of character within themselves that they also have to accept as a being a person that not only does this to do harm to Larry or whoever else, but also the fact that they're so insidious that they can't even remember. And that's because, you know, that's how evil and terrible they are. And it is just really powerful to witness. So I recommend, you know, any audience to check that out just from that point of view so that when we reference something like the hot seat, you can actually see it happening in real time in that program, which I thought was.
And that's the degradation in Biderman's chart. And there are so many forms of it, like the use of collateral in Nixium, where if you couldn't think of something awful that you'd done to confess to, you had to make something up, which could then be used against you should you ever choose to leave. Scientology has its security checking, also called integrity processing, where they collect everything and anything about you. And people do start to invent things. False memories are constructed, which people, and after I left, they introduced this great thing called the truth rundown, which Chris Shelton has experienced and talked very eloquently about, where, something awful has happened to you in the organization. And you complain about it and they sit you down until you confess that you made it up. So it's a kind of incredible form of gaslighting.
Wow. Yeah.
And, it's where my friend Christian Cherko has this, where we delegate our reality testing to another person. So Lifton's ideology over experience, doctrine over person, where even real events, things that have happened to us, we now dismiss because they can't have happened to us. So that, reality becomes permeable.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's so, it's hard to believe unless you experience it on some level, or in this case, you can witness it. It is hard to fathom. I mean, we've all found ourselves in relationships where someone was maybe controlling us and diminishing us, like that degradation type of thing, and doing some gaslighting. It can be happening on a very subtle basis when you are actually overtly like put on the so-called hot seat and verbally attacked and being challenged to create acts that you have not actually committed but are going to now then become part of the dogma of the reality that you're living in. I mean, it's hard to imagine how that happens. So I think it's really, really powerful to see it, because I'm going to now use that as a reference tool for anyone in relation to that, because I just think it is hard to imagine, and that, boy, I'll tell you, that thing captures it.
Let me say that when I interviewed people who'd worked in the Guardian's office, the what is now the Office of Special Affairs, very special affairs, that I got this guy told me that many of his fellows who worked in the harassment and intelligence department, and I knew nothing about these people when I was involved. There was a real, Chinese wall between us and them. That he said that many of them were basically doing what they were doing to do something positive to pay back for the time they'd spent in their last lifetime in the Gestapo.
Wow.
And you go, so you can tinker with somebody's reality by saying, in a past life, you did this awful thing. And then that brings us the myth of karma, this idea that if something awful happens to you, it's your own fault. And there is no chance in the universe. It's all, you know, which baffles me completely that anybody thinking back could say, well, you know, after the Big Bang,
yeah,
there can be no free will. There can be no determination. You know, it's all just little marbles being knocked around, because that first cause will cause the first reaction. And, you know, you've got the idea of original sin in Christianity and it seems a little unfair to me that because Eve persuaded Adam to eat an apple, women have to suffer in childbirth.
Yeah, for the rest of eternity. Yeah, yeah.
It's a little bit heavy-handed, I think, on God's part.
Yeah, so. Yeah, I would say. No, I mean, in Eternal Values, our leader, Freddie, I remember him telling someone that back in our time we all shared together in Egypt, that she had said something that led to his beheading, and she now held that karma, you know, and that becomes dogma, and that becomes the thing. And so you can imagine the psychological heaviness that is on someone's psyche to think like, oh, in the past, I said something or did something that led to this person losing their head. Mm-hmm. You know, what kind of a manipulation that works in someone's psyche? You know,
and yet Hitler, Stalin, and Mao between them could kill, what, about 150, 200 million people, and nothing happened to them. You know, you'd think they'd have tripped down the stairs or something as karmic retribution after the first million or so, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the karma thing's a whole nother conversation we actually could get into sometime, because I think it is fascinating. Mm. I do love the sense of accountability of this, for every reaction, there might be an equal and opposite reaction somewhere. And that, I guess for me, the Christian approach of thinking that you can just go in church and you can have your slate clean, as long as you put the money in the till and you listen to the sermon, everything's fine. You can go back and do what you want. As long as you come next week, your slate will be clean again. You know, I was like, hold on a second. You know, where is the accountability in that? Right.
Yeah, let's put a little historical point into that. The Emperor Constantine, who introduced Christianity to the Roman Empire and sort of enforced it at the beginning of the 4th century. Back then, 300 and whatever AD, you got to confess once and your sins were forgiven. And if you sinned again, then sorry, you've used your get out of jail card.
Oh, really?
That's it. No, and that meant that Constantine, in fact, he kept his confessor with him at all times. But he didn't confess. He was waiting to, you know, hoping he wouldn't be struck dead immediately. No, he also is a little bit narcissistic that his mother, Helena, reckoned that she'd collected the bones of all 12 of the apostles and that they were going to be arranged in a circle around her son's sarcophagus. So they didn't have Jesus. He'd obviously resurrected and gone back to heaven. But it does seem a little bit strange, as the foundation of the church, both the Orthodox and the Catholic Church, come out of, you know, that period. You could only be, and then somebody went, oh, I know what we'll do. We'll sell indulgences. So you can, if you have a certain amount of masses sung, which will cost you, £300,000, let's say, then you won't have to spend time in purgatory waiting to go to heaven. You can go straight there and your sins will be forgiven. And there's a bloke in Germany called Martin Luther who didn't particularly like that idea. There was another bloke in Switzerland called Zwingli who nobody seems to mention, who similarly had a problem, and there were people before them. But this whole idea of, I can buy a place, I can... No, sorry, you have to be virtuous. And, as I have often said, virtue is its own punishment. And, karma, really? Don't think so. Yeah.
And I think it also goes back to Lipton's thing, you know, the cult of confession, how powerful that is to get someone to create the environment where, if you just tell us your horrible secrets and atrocities, then you'll be safe, not recognizing that they're keeping a dossier and going to use that against you, you know, now that you've confessed.
And I think the fact of confession puts you in the supplicant position. So, and then when Barbara Tuchman, the March of Folly, she has six periods in history leading up to Vietnam, which she was criticizing quite severely at a time when it was still happening. And she's saying, here are six periods in history where the leaders have been idiots, Vietnam being the final one. And one of them is the six popes, including the popes who hired Michelangelo, Pope Julius and Pope Alexander. And when you find what these guys were doing, and you're going, this is the, you know, God is above them. They're the top of this institution. So, and I'm going to say this, you've used the F word, so I'm going to say this. there's a scene where Lucrezia Borgia, the most famous poisoner of her time, is sat with her dad, who's the Pope, so much for celibacy among priests. Yeah. He was also, her brother was Cesare Borgia, for whom The Prince was written by Machiavelli, an absolutely sadistic tyrant. And they're in the Vatican and they're sat watching prostitutes picking up chestnuts with their underparts. Yeah. And you go, and all below them are, you know, having to confess and do all of this stuff. You're going, and it is such a classic cult position that when you research the life of Sun Myung Moon or L. Ron Hubbard, which I've done, you find that they did not follow the rules that they set for anybody else. And again, that's enforcing trivial demands that we have to, you know, do as we're told. Hubbard had this thing, it's a lecture in December 52, where he talks about life's a game. Everything's a game. Let's just, you know, because we live forever. And so it's all great, good fun. And we're having a game, you know, murdering one another and torturing one another and all of that. And in the game, you have pieces. And the important thing for the pieces is that they never find out what the rules are. And then you have players. And their job is to keep the rules hidden from the pieces. And then he talks about the game maker. And he says, of course, the game maker doesn't have to follow the rules. And so you find out about this man who violated every one of the rules that he set forward. You know, even, you know, simple things about not having a counseling session when you've been drinking, not having a counseling session when you've not slept properly. He would be woken up. I interviewed Mike Rinder and he'd say he'd be woken up at 3 a.m. to have a counseling, do his own counseling session when he evidently, and then he'd be woken again at 6 to do another one. And one, you know, and the counselor, the auditor's meant to control the session. And there are all these times when Hubbard would just stop the person who was meant to be counseling him and say, write this down. His drug taking was also something that was contrary to the rules that were enforced. And he confessed he actually advocated taking amphetamines in 1950 in a number of places. If you have to grab hold of anything, grab hold of Benzedrine. And I quote exactly, the amphetamine. He also confessed to having made himself a guinea pig in an experiment to become addicted to and come off phenobarbital, barbiturates, very strong drugs indeed. Yeah. So the cult leader is, well, we got these whores in off the streets to see if they could pick these chestnuts up with their nether parts and or their undercarriage, and that's okay for us. Well, you have to confess to having, well, possibly watched prostitutes picking up chestnuts.
Yeah, you know? Right, exactly. Yeah.
So one rule for the leader and another rule for everybody below. And I think we have to be aware of that. We shouldn't excuse that. So a final one, Hubbard said, as does Christian Science and The Secret and so many of these con jobs, that everything that happens to you is your fault. So if you're ill, it's because you've been unethical. Right. Hubbard was ill every year.
Or negative thoughts or something like that, you know, whatever it may be, right?
Yeah, you haven't had attractive laws to make things come to you. And he, every winter, would be horribly sick with bronchial pneumonia. But that was not because of his overts, his transgressions. That was because he was researching this difficult material, you know. And he smoked 100 cigarettes a day and founded a drug rehabilitation group. It's like, okay. And he also shouted his head off at people with giving them severe reality adjustments, as it's called, which is, again, is the degradation, the threats part of the what's his name? Biderman.
Yeah, so, I mean, the double standard is so on point, and you know, it's do what I say, not do as I do, right? And I certainly remember with my cult leader, you know, he would you know, because he was taking drugs unbeknownst to us, you know, so he'd be up at 3 a.m. decide, oh, the slip covers on the sofas all needed to be washed at that moment, you know, and he'd wake everyone up, and we had to go down to you know, the basement and watch these things, and all under the guise that you know, we needed to wake up on an instant, because in the near future, when the apocalypse is coming and we need to be ready to move on an instant, this is just part of the training. And you would, so you're woken up at 3 a.m. and you got to go down and clean these things. And it was, you know, and the same sort of thing when he even became ill, you know, it wasn't because, oh, he was covertly having these sexual escapades and developed HIV and got AIDS. No, it was because he had been taken on the karma of all of us, and that's why he was so ill. So all of it's always your fault. It's always your fault. They're never at any fault at all. And you know, I think and this gets into a lot of the psychology stuff of the, you know, way cults operate, and you know, through the cult leader, I think, you know, the fear and the guilt and the, you know, the information being controlled, all of those things are things that become modus operandum and become part of the system that you just learn to accept, because very often what you bought into from an idealistic point of view sounds so attractive to you, you can't recognize that what you're actually living is not what you signed up for. Mm. You know, you're just so convinced that what you signed up for sounded so good, and I feel so good about being part of something that would potentially become that, that I'm just got to go along to get along to survive, because ultimately I feel like it's all worth it, in the sense that, you know, all the so-called punishments that you endure, even though they might be called chores or whatever way that it gets framed, those are all part of the training for you to become more self-realized or enlightened, whatever way it's been spun. And you just don't even recognize really what's happening, which is just flat out abuse.
Yeah.
I mean, there's
some kind of peak experience or what Yuval Lowell calls an awe experience, somewhere near the beginning where you have a realization of how life could be and how wonderful things could be, and you've bought your ticket to paradise, and then you'll have to suffer.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And actually that brings me to the thing that I wanted to talk about, this other chapter in this tribe book, which is about, and he has this whole chapter called War Makes You an Animal. And he uses, you know, the war as a great analogy, in my opinion, to what some of the psychological manipulation that happens in cults of getting you excited about an ideal and how that can now then be manipulated against you. So in essence, you know, I got to put my glasses on for this, you know, I can't read. What I loved was, you know, that he talks about how signing up for, you know, the military is this idea that you're going to be part of something bigger than yourself, right? And
identity can be, can become part of a larger thing, a noble cause.
Exactly. You know, so it's the idea that you're living in a country that has certain, like in America, you have certain rights and certain freedoms, and because of that, you owe your country. And there, which is, listen, there's truth to that. But again, it's like you realize like how that can easily be manipulated against you, right? You know, it's like, oh, because of this place where you are, you now owe us, and you now have to go, you know, contribute in some way. And I think if you're at a point where you're directionless, that's a very appealing scenario to say, oh, I've got a direction now. And it seems like you say it's a noble cause. And so that's all what I like to call the perfect storm. That's what kind of needs to happen for you to have the entry point. Mm-hmm. You know, you just need to be feeling like you should have a game plan, feeling like you don't, and someone presents you one, that certainly sounds better than your no plan. And you're going to jump on board just because at least it feels like it's a forward movement. It's something that you could get emotionally or psychologically behind, not recognizing that there's potential in there for you to be manipulated.
Yeah. And it's interesting to look at all human collectives from that perspective as tribes, cults, nations. You know, the nation is a pretty modern idea that up until really probably the English Civil War in the 1640s, there's very little conception of a nation, of belonging to a group of people, other than where you are defending yourself against interlopers, people attacking. But this idea then really takes hold, this idea, you know, Garibaldi in Italy. And when you read about that period, you find that there were people who didn't want to become Italians. they wanted to remain Sicilians. They didn't want to be pulled into this great thing. And, you know, looking at this country, you know, we've just put Charles III on the throne. And let's hope he's not as bad as Charles I and Charles II. But you're sort of going, well, so who is this person? And is he the very essence of Englishness? Well, of course, at the beginning of the First World War, his great-grandparents or what have you had to change their name from Saxe-Coburg-Gotha, which is a little bit German, to Windsor, which is a kind of soup. And, you know, you kind of go, well, actually, the antecedents of this family, that there was a Scottish royal family that took over, James I, Charles I, they were Scottish. They weren't English. And what does English mean anyway? How does that come together? So you create this symbolic collective. You know, you call it the Roman Catholic Church or the International Society for Krishna Consciousness or the National Socialist Party. You create a collective, and people then sense, they come to believe that their identity is dependent upon membership in this collective and fulfilling the aims of the collective. And then you get what Solzhenitsyn calls for the good of the cause. This idea that, well, we are going to have to, so looking at Heinrich Himmler's talks to the SS, and Heinrich Himmler was a great proponent of mindfulness meditation and of yoga. Senior SS men studied these things under Himmler's direction. Not a lot of people know that. So when we're told by Jon Kabat-Zinn that mindfulness inevitably leads to compassion, we have to go, well, didn't lead the Japanese army there, and they did it every day. We have to be careful about what we're saying. But people identify with this group. And the Germans were told, you know, Himmler, there are these awful directives to the people running the death camps saying, what you're having to do is terrible work. It's awful work, but it has to be done. These vermin have to be destroyed for the good of humanity. And so drink German beer and sing German songs at the end of the day. And you go, when you say German, Heinrich, that's German. That's a nation that only came into being in the 1870s. It's only existed since then. The Prussians and the Saxons really hadn't been getting on all that well. And suddenly we've got this national fusion. When you look at the United States, there are at least 11 different nations within the United States because of the groups that settled and because of the customs and mores that they brought. So the most savage culture in the South, they're borderers. They're people who came from the Scots borders, from either north of it or south of it. And that was a lawless territory for centuries where people fought with each other. And a characteristic of that, I mean, Thomas Sowell writes about this, black anthropologist. A characteristic of this is, are you looking at me? You know, you've got to respect me, because it's a constant war culture. And that has now, you know, that was passed into the West Africans who were stolen from their land and forced into the most awful slavery, that culture became what they were subjected to. And Sowell, a black anthropologist, reckons that carried on. I think William Du Bois, the first of the great black anthropologists around about 1900, he talks about something called the religion of whiteness. And this idea that racism doesn't really seem to have existed until around the 17th century is as far back as I can get it, Bacon's Rebellion in the 17th century. So even this collective of we're black, we're white, these are imaginary communities. They're imagined communities. So I was talking with a friend about patriotism, and he's an American. He's saying, I'm a patriot. And I'm saying, well, do you know what that means? I mean, can we look it up? Because I'm not sure. And it's fundamentally being willing to give your life for your nation. But he wouldn't be willing to give it for Democrats, I don't think.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think that's this component of the collective and aligning yourself with the noble cause and all those things. The crucial point of it is that you need the enemy, right? It creates the enemy. You only create the group because you have to create the us, and then there's the them, right? And this is a primary control tactic of any controlling relationship, and certainly with cults. And it goes back to even what you were talking about, the isolation. You know, you have to separate, and you're now part of us, and now everyone else is them, right? So I think that's such a crucial part of it. And it's the same way war is used. War only becomes necessary because there's an enemy, right? I mean, if you didn't have an enemy, there's no reason for war. So I think it's a fascinating thing that even in the microcosm of a one-on-one cultic relationship, where the common tactic is, oh, now that you're aligned with me, you have to distrust everyone else, and they'll pit you against your friends, pit you against your family, because your only safe place is with me. Mm. You know, the cult does that on a group dynamic as well. It's like, now that we've chosen you because you're special, because you're shown these incredible traits or whatever, you know, the indoctrination process was, now you're part of us. Now we have to protect ourselves against them. And I think that's something that is a powerful dynamic that we don't realize how common it is everywhere in the world, just even on the most simple relationships, and how that is a position where we get easily controlled without recognizing it's happening.
And we accept generalizations about others, either, as you say, because they're seen as enemies, and they may be enemies, and we may need to get together to stop the Vikings from coming and bashing our heads in. Though even that seems to have a certain degree of propaganda in it. There do seem to have been settlements that were very successful in the north of England, where there were Vikings living alongside Angles, Saxons, Romano, Celts, whatever. But it's either, as you say, because there's an enemy, or there's a perception of superiority. We are cultured. Our views are enlightened, and they're savages. And you can understand that when you read, you know, the Chinese writing about the people that surrounded them. You can certainly understand why they were upset with the Mongols. You know, they keep coming and killing us all. The Japanese elitism, Pan-Slavism. We know about the Pan-German ideas that became Nazism, Aryanism, which is a complete fabrication and nonsense. I've read deeply into the origins of Aryan race theory. And it was these two mad individuals at the beginning of the 20th century. But people have perhaps forgotten that alongside that, that was a division within the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It's an Austrian thing, the Pan-German idea, because you've got all of the, you know, the Austrian army had a really big problem that they didn't speak the same language. You know, you had all of these language groups, the Magyar Hungarians and the Czechs speaking, you know, their language and all of this stuff. So you had a Pan-German movement coming out, which was, if you speak German, then you belong to this group and whatever your antecedents. But there was also Pan-Slavism at that time. What we're seeing in Ukraine at the moment is a Pan-Slavic argument that's been going on for a very long time between two Slavic groups. And as Hitler pointed out, the word Slav and the word slave come from the same place, and he had an intention towards them, which was not fulfilled. I co-wrote a chapter with Steve Hassan and two others called Psychiatry and Anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. And because I've been commissioned to do this, I sort of thought, well, what is anti-Semitism?
Mm.
You know, how is this group formed? How is it defined? So that I can understand what anti-Semitism is. What is being a Semite? And originally, it's a descendant of Shem, Ham, Shem, and Japha. Japha, of course, here we have the Japha cake, which is a kind of biscuit with marmalade in it, which is
really
unknown in America. And that's what came from Japha. But the Shemites were originally the Arab and Hebrew and Babylonian peoples. And then it sort of got refined down so that it is now only Jewish people. And I was sort of, well, what is it that makes that collective, the Jewish collective? And I'd already read Arthur Koestler's 13th Tribe, you know, 35 years ago or something, where he puts forward the argument that the people who migrated to Israel in the late 19th and 20th century actually had no genetic roots there. They were Khazar converts from Eastern Europe.
Interesting. Okay.
There was a situation in the 9th century where this country found itself in between Christianity and Islam, both trying to convert it, and it's a buffer zone. And they converted the whole population to Judaism, and then they disappear into history. And there's an incredible book by a guy called Shlomo Sand, who's actually a friend of our friend Yuval Laor, who teaches at Tel Aviv University. And Tel Aviv University has a department of history and a department of Jewish history, and they're separate. He's in the Department of History, and the people in the Department of Jewish History don't talk to him anymore because he wrote a book called The Invention of the Jewish People. And you come to this point where it's like, well, genetically, these people are not from they're not the Habiru, the Hebrew tribe. 40% of Israelis are atheists, so it's not a religious group. It's a group that's developed, a collective, in resistance to aggression from outsiders, to a large part. So, you know, the Haredi, the so-called ultra-Orthodox Jews who have the ringlets and the hats and stuff like that, they are actually mimicking 18th century forms of dress, rather than the Amish. This isn't how people dressed 5,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago or however. And we start going that these collectives change through time. So what is, you know, if we looked at the US, up until 1847, Californians would have been Spanish-speaking for the most part. They are again now, because this territory didn't belong to the United States. The United States was originally just the New England states, and then you get the Louisiana Purchase. And I think the last bit to go was Oregon. And some would say that it still hasn't gone yet. and it was still held by the British until, I believe, after. And if somebody, if I'm wrong and somebody knows, please tell me in the comments. Please tell us. But I think Oregon was the last bit. And then, of course, Alaska is bought from the Russians.
Yeah.
San Francisco had been largely settled by the Russians, and you've got a Chinese population. What is the nation anymore? If you're a Korean American, an Italian American, an Irish American, what is the group and how does it become the super group, which is the country, which at this moment is not united at all? These are not United States. These are disunited states with all sorts of upsets and disagreements where, you know, the first peoples, the Native Americans, and I'm told that I'm not meant to say Native American anymore. It gets so confusing, not insulting people because of everybody, they do have the right to choose what they're called. I absolutely agree with that. But it doesn't mean I'm going to start calling Paris Paris, you know, or Copenhagen Copenhaven. You know, it's too difficult to remember what I meant to do. And I really mean no insult using the term Native American. But we start then getting the romance of, well, the Native Americans were hundreds of different groups at war with one another or trying to resist being overtaken, you know. And where is their territory? The Apache came, I think, from Alaska all the way down. The Lakota, and, you know, what's happened at Mount Rushmore is horrific, you know. You know, these are the sacred Black Hills, but they only occupied the sacred Black Hills in about the 16th century. Who owns which bit? If the Jews, if we said that they did actually come from Israel in the first place, and Judea,
mm-hmm.
then do we all have the right to go back to the place where our ancestors lived 2,000 years ago? Should London belong to the Welsh?
Mm-hmm.
Because they were there more recently than 2,000 years ago.
Right.
And can we accept that our identities are malleable and that that we can form groups and perhaps not need to hate people who belong to other groups, you know? And perhaps it is that hatred that is the fundamental problem that makes our tribalism so dangerous, this idea that we follow leaders who are, history tells us, stupid tyrants, almost right. all of them, you know, trying yeah. to look for a decent leader. You know, we had good Queen Bess, Queen Elizabeth I in this country, who spent more time with her chief torturer than any other official during her reign.
Wow.
Discussing different ways of hurting people. But she was good, you know, good Queen Bess.
Well, you know, what's interesting about, you know, the whole war thing, and this is what this guy talks about, is there are some positives that come out of the war scenario in the sense, right? So this is where it gets very commingled. And this is where, again, I think it's an interesting subject matter because you can see how cults exploit this. I mean, he makes an example at one point of how, like, when natural catastrophes happen, like earthquakes and things, how, you know, basically when an earthquake happens, you know, the people who get either, you know, their homes damaged or left homeless, it's very equal. It happens to the rich and the poor. So there's like an even playing field that happens. And what ends up happening is people pull together and actually look out for each other, because you have to have just like food and water and just shelter, and people kind of pull together in this really wonderful communal way. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, is this experience that you all kind of have of like, oh, brings out the best in mankind, so to speak. And yeah. and then, but that's, which is real. And then of course, when things stabilize, then everyone goes back to their, you know, to their castle if they've got one, or back to the slums or wherever they live. Like, it's a temporary situation, but that can be sold as an ideal of like, oh, if we just eliminate everyone's money, if we just, you know, if we become a commune, then we will have this kind of utopian environment where we all are all equal. It's all going to be wonderful. Mm-hmm. So it's a great selling point, because there is some validity that in these situations, that this is what happens in war. And he goes into the whole thing about the Blitz, you know, in London, of how, you know, they were so worried about when the Blitz was happening in London, that there was going to be just mayhem and there were going to be police and there's going to be looting. And in fact, the opposite happened. People really pulled together. They looked out for each other. You know, they really hobbled together and became a real sense of community, which was unexpected. So you can see these examples, and then you can understand how, because they're real and people actually had those experiences, that you can then, in a cultic situation, say, oh, this is what we're trying to create here. This is the chance for us all to be able to have this experience where we don't see differences in one another. We're all equal and we're all in it together. And the truth is that when people are united in a cause, there's, and he gets into this, you know, there's a decrease in mental illness. Like once you've got something you're all aligned to do, you know, you stop worrying about your little petty things and it all becomes about survival and all those sort of things. And so I think it's a fascinating point to raise, because it's not easily something that you can, paint very, very distinctly and say, oh, you can't do this and you can't do that because there's no benefit to here or there. I mean, there's experiences that come out of war, as horrible as war are, that actually teach people a lot about their own character and about what their potential is in a crisis. And so you can't say that's not part of it. So I think it's a fascinating subject. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Viktor Frankl in Man's Search for Meaning, which I believe everybody should read, talks about, you know, all of the petty things, like, you know, that you can't sleep without your special herb pillow. And, right. you know, people overcome all sorts of difficulties and form community. There were tensions in the Blitz. Winston Churchill ordered that people could not shelter in the underground stations. And people just ignored him.
Exactly.
And if they hadn't, there would have been massively more casualties. The crime rate soared during World War II. There were more murders. There was more theft. But there was also this communal spirit that you talk about. And the wartime spirit, often referred to when I was a child. You know, why aren't we pulling together like we did then?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
How you can genuinely make that community work. Muzaffar Sharif in the Robber's Cave experiment, and I'm very sad to say that the experiment itself is questionable, because Sharif did prompt the boys to attack each other. This is where children of about 12 years old were brought together, kids who didn't know each other, formed into two groups in a summer camp, and then one group is they form a group, and then they're told there's this other group, and the two groups pretty much fight war against each other. And very positive things happen. For example, there was a kid who didn't know how to swim and who'd been belittled in the group as it came together. But now they had an enemy, they taught him how to swim. And so the group coheres, and the members of the group, for the most part, I mean, the psychopath is the psychopath and they will cause harm wherever they are. But for the most part, the group is more empathetic. The end of that experiment is not talked about enough, because he wanted to see what would happen if you created a situation where they had to work together, and it was to do with the water supply, and all of the kids had to work together. And what happened was, these kids who'd been trying to murder each other a few days before now went home quite happily on buses with the two groups intermixed, and they became friends. So, which is, you know, I'd hoped when I first read about this, which is about 30 years ago, that by talking about the environment and us all coming together to do something to make our environment secure for the next generation, that could bring humanity together. And unfortunately, there are aspects of rampant selfishness that have prevented that from happening. And, you know, all of the arguments against global warming and whether it's caused by people or not, that was a big thing. And I'm kind of going, but pouring mercury into rivers, whether it's warming the planet up or not, it's not very good for us, or DDT. I didn't realize this. DDT is still in use in Africa.
Wow.
This thing that goes all the way through the food chain and kills everything. It's still being used because it kills pests, you know. So you'd have thought that there'd be some better consciousness that we could develop, especially now that we have this incredible World Wide Web.
Yes.
Where we can communicate all of these great ideas. And instead, we have megaphoning. This is my word of the week, which I think I've invented. I saw this thing a year or so back where there were people who represented themselves as belonging to Antifa. And I know there are people who say there's no such thing as Antifa. Or members of Black Lives Matter or what have you,
right.
And people who represented themselves as part of what is now being called the hard right, what was called the alt-right, and there are other words for it. And I saw this video of these people aligned up against each other with megaphones, screaming obscenities at each other from a yard away, and you're going, how intelligent is that? You know, how useful is that? Where is that going to lead us? How do we resolve this sense of conflict, which has absolutely been whipped up through a sense of identity? I belong to this. You know, the current trend to say of white guilt, the idea that I need to apologize for what my ancestors did. Well, I have a very simple answer to that, and I've used it before. Mengele, the angel of death at Auschwitz, the man who the doctor who decided who was going to die immediately and who was going to be worked to death, he fled, you know, for some reason didn't want to be hung at Nuremberg, so off he went. His son was, I think, 4 years old when he went. Now, collective guilt. Well, I'm afraid the child is guilty too, obviously. You know, we're going to pass on the guilt to the next generation.
Right.
He spent his life exposing the crimes of his father. And I do not believe that the sins of the father are passed on even until the fourth generation. I'm not responsible for slavery. I'm absolutely not responsible for it, nor was my dad. In fact, my dad was at Belsen, at the liberation of Belsen. So, you know, and fought, and he was at Dunkirk, he was at Normandy. He fought for an ideal which I still support. I have a Marxist friend many years ago who accused me of believing in a good war. And it was like, well, I don't think the war was fought very sensibly. I think it was a huge mess and it could have been, you know, much better done. And it wouldn't have led to the collapse of British influence as it did. And the, you know, the power blocks of Russia, China and the US, if it had been thought through a little better by Winston Churchill. But nonetheless, I think it was right to stand up to Hitler. I think it would also have been right to stand up to Stalin, though. So have a bit of a problem there.
Yeah, exactly.
But sometimes it is necessary to come together and defend values. The problem is, you know, we had it under Tony Blair, that Tony Blair actually took out of law 8 aspects of the European Declaration of Human Rights. 8 points were ruled out by a government to protect our freedom. The Patriot Act in the US.
Oh, yeah. Completely.
People ran to sign and you're going, but you've just taken away the very liberties that we wish to give to the world.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Well, I wanted to read this part that I think is really exactly what we're saying. So this guy, Charles Fritz, became an open critic of the rationale behind the bombing of the campaign in the Second World War. Mm-hmm. He said, intrigued by the fact that both England and Germany, civilian resilience had risen in response to the air raids, Fritz went on to complete a more general study of how communities respond to calamity. After the war, he turned his attention to the natural disasters of the United States and formulated a broad theory about social resilience. He was unable to find a single instance where communities that had been hit by catastrophic events lapsed into sustained panic, much less anything approaching anarchy. If anything, he found social bonds were reinforced during disasters, and people overwhelmingly devoted their energies towards the good of the community rather than just themselves. Fritz's starting premise was that modern society had greatly disrupted the social bonds that have always characterized the human experience, and that disasters thrust people back into a more ancient, organic way of relating. Disasters, he proposed, created a community of sufferers that allows individuals to experience immensely reassuring connection to others. As people come together to face an existential threat, class differences are temporarily erased. Income disparities become irrelevant, race is overlooked, individuals are assessed simply by what they're willing to do for their group. It's kind of a fleeting social utopia.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that's such a, you know, that's so interesting to recognize that you can, and again, I'm not going to give cult leaders the brain power to figure this all out, but the fact that when you create the us versus them and you're in a sense of a war, that it, you know, you've got the, whether it gets framed at, you know, they're the ones who are still stuck in the matrix and we pulled you out. You know, this, once you've got that kind of warlike dynamic happening, that unification of a cause and the feeling that we have a purpose can bring out really positive qualities in people initially. And I think that those are the things that are undeniable, that when you get seduced into these groups, you have those experiences on the early, you know, you talk a very, which I've learned from you so much about, why did you stay? I think that initial part of the indoctrination of thinking you're feeling a part of something, you've got a purpose, you've got a cause, I've got like-minded people around me, I've got, you know, my brothers in arms, that is a very, very euphoric, you know, idealistic kind of a situation to it that you didn't think you would ever experience otherwise. And that can be built upon in the sense that you actually have that experience. So it's not that you didn't have it, but you don't realize that it's been artificially created, and it's also part of a massive long-term manipulation tactic. Mm-hmm. You know, but initially you're having these tangible, positive, emotional responses that's hard to deny. And that's why I think it's really important for people to realize, like, there are things that happen in these groups that are undeniably kind of eye-opening and kind of can expand your mind in some way, but you don't recognize that that's only putting you in a position to down the road to be manipulated even more, you know? And so it's like, you just don't see it coming. And this is where I try to relay these things to people, is just say, listen, it's so not black and white. It's so commingled with some things that actually have that are positive that are happening, that are allowing you to recognize you do have greater potential than maybe you've been exercising before you got involved in this group. You could look at things differently. You could be less selfish. You could, you know, kind of take one for the team and do all these things, you know, self-sacrifice and all these sort of things. All those sort of experiences teach us that we have, you know, greater potential than maybe we did before. And then all that gets projected onto the cult and potentially the cult leader. Look what they've taught me about myself. And then you're in a position where like, oh, I'm going to believe whatever they tell me. And then boy, the walls come down and you get crushed. All of the guys that I'm still part of, I'm engaging in the training that's going to make a better version of me. And you don't realize that that's not, it's kind of a bait and switch in a sense, you know?
Yeah, the goodness that is there in the camaraderie, the collaboration, can be betrayed by the ethos of the leader.
Yeah.
You know, whoever comes to be the ideologue or idealist of the group, that then, so if we look at, during the Blitz, it's the largest experiment ever conducted, because a group called Mass Observation in the UK had started up before the war and were having a lot of people keep diaries and make reports. And as you say, the anticipation was that if the idea of the Blitz was to destroy the morale of the British people, right. And it did exactly the opposite.
Right.
That people did not become panic-stricken anxiety wrecks. They pulled together for the good of the cause. Of course, some few people didn't, but it went against expectation. And it's also a reason why in Korea and Vietnam, the campaigns to absolutely destroy the enemy. You know, the end of the, well, is there an end actually? I'm not sure there ever was, but in 1953, the Korean War was meant to end. At the end of that war, there was not one town standing in North Korea.
Wow.
In Vietnam, wow. More munitions were dropped on Vietnam than were dropped during the whole of World War II, than were used during the whole of World War II. The environment was utterly devastated. And this idea of, you know, we will exterminate you. We've seen the Russians in Syria try the same policy, and in Ukraine, they're trying the same policy. And ultimately, it doesn't. The Vietnamese have proved to be an incredibly resilient people. The North Koreans are still really trapped. But, you know, nonetheless, China, you know, where 70 million people died while Mao Zedong was their leader, they are now an industrial and military titan, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I speak as somebody, I, you know, the Chinese people, I have every respect for the current blank paper protests. I just think they're it's such an innovation to say, just go in the street and hold up a piece of blank paper. How can you arrest somebody for that? And it's all over China. And they're basically behind that is, this is all I'm allowed to say.
Wow.
I
didn't realize that was happening. No, yeah. That's happening right now.
Yes, that it would seem, I've been talking with a couple of China watchers recently, and it's happening all over China. 3 years of being locked down has actually made people think that they're outside of the behavioral repetition that keeps the patterns going. And they're going, this is a rotten life, what I'm being forced to do. You know, and the tyranny. I mean, I think, yeah, we have this thing with Russia recently, and I'm going to say this publicly. A group called Fekris, which is the umbrella group for counter-cult groups in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
I've been the keynote speaker at two Fekris conferences in Riga and in Copenhagen 10 years ago nearly now. And this group has money that's poured into it from the European Union.
Mm-hmm.
And they have just, in the last few weeks, they've thrown out their three Russian correspondents. And I wrote a letter of protest about this, which until now has only been distributed among the leaders of Fekris. Right. Because I think it's outrageous that the idea that these people are Russian, and one of them is a good friend of mine, Professor Alexander Dvorkin, who I've known since 1993. He stayed in my house you know, we're chums. This is a man who has taken no money whatsoever in all those years, in 30 years, traveled all over Eastern Europe. He is a professor of medieval history. He works 3 days a week teaching to support his family. And he then gives his time freely and without pay and has helped thousands of people with some of the worst cults in the world, Vissarion in Siberia or Umshinrikyo, which did not disappear after the sarin gas attacks in Tokyo. It's still there. And he's given himself completely selflessly to these causes. He's written many papers and investigated many groups. And he is a remarkable and brilliant man. And he suddenly finds that he's been thrown out. He's been on the board of Fekris throughout this time. He's thrown out, along with the two other Russian correspondents. And as far as I can tell from what's been said, it's because he's Russian. And the Russians are now the enemy.
And that's it.
I spoke at a conference in St. Petersburg in 2014, which was remarkable. And there were 200 Orthodox priests there from all over, you know, 210 million Orthodox Christians in the world. And there were from Jerusalem, from Greece, from Poland, and from Ukraine. And I saw Ukrainian priests embracing Russian priests. So the idea that because the, excuse me, complete bastards who rule the world are at loggerheads with one another.
Yeah.
You know, or one set of them are attacking another set, that we now have to demonize all of the people of that nation.
Yeah, exactly.
What nation, you know? So these are experts on cults who've just done this.
Wow. You know,
where are we?
Because it's really about, you know, the bullies run the show, right? I mean, that's what it really is. The tyrants, the bullies, right? And they're the ones that get you into these wars, you know, and it really becomes like a, for lack of a better description, a dick measuring contest. You know, that's what they're all, it's just kind of unadulterated. It's almost like machismo. I don't even know how to describe it, but it's so interesting to see how that then becomes the label. And then anyone who's clearly coerced behind them, just in the general populace, they all just get guilty by association. And as if they're all on, you know, in one line of what they all believe is the same thing. It's just, there's no way it's that way.
And understanding that if in Russia you say that there's a war against Ukraine, you're sent to prison. It's illegal to say that. And something like 20,000 people have been sent to prison for suggesting that the incredible military action against Ukraine is a war. And they're being told that it's because Zelensky is a Nazi. And on the other side, we've got this notion, and I find myself in the middle of most conflicts when I look at it, that I don't like to take sides. It doesn't seem useful to me. Sometimes, of course, you have to, you know, when horrors are being committed, I'm against that. But the reality here is that we've left the European Union because of immigration. That's the real reason that most people voted to leave, because they don't want people from the European Union here. But we now have given a free pass to 3 million people from Hong Kong. And I think it's quite right that we should.
Right.
But it's more people than we can accommodate. And we've also given a free pass to Ukrainians at the same time that we're stopping refugees, people who, for example, in Afghanistan, when the Allies withdrew, they left behind the list of names of all of the Afghans who'd helped. And the Taliban got those lists.
Oh, and boy.
It's pretty inevitable in any country that if you've assisted the invading force, you will now suffer for it. It's just the way it is.
Yeah.
And those people were not granted refugee status. So they are now coming, traveling all the way from Afghanistan, ending up on little boats trying to cross over and drowning. And we're having people in this country saying, well, the lifeboats shouldn't save them. They should be left to die. So immigration of those people is wrong. We've got all of these Ukrainians. We're also pouring now, are we in the hundreds of billions now, into weapons to support Ukraine in fighting against Russia. Now, tell me 10 facts about Ukraine. How many people actually know anything? So when the first Iraq war, first invasion of Iraq happened in, what was it, 91, yeah. I was in this little town called Bishop, California. And I used to smoke cigarettes then, long ago. It's been a long time, 25 years since I stopped. And so I needed a packet of cigarettes and go into a shop. I was a little alarmed by the gun on the wall behind the guy, you know, the shotgun, just in case anything happened, just huge guy. And I was with a friend who was a journalist and a lot more quick-witted than I am. And this guy said, what do you think about Iraq? And while I was kind of stumbling around trying to find words, my friend managed to say something very neutral. And this guy said, I think we should bomb those fuckers flat. And it was like, you know, this is the cradle of civilization.
Yeah.
You know that they're human beings. You know that they've been persecuted by Saddam Hussein all of these years, and you want to kill them all.
Yeah.
I think that says, and there's our problem, that hatred, that sense of the other as dangerous.
Yeah, exactly.
Which, of course, cult groups, you know, Hitler said all you need to do is create an enemy. And cult groups have, you know, in Scientology, and this word is used so casually by non-British Scientologists, you'll recognize it because you've lived here. Non-Scientologists are called WOGs.
Mm.
Now, in this country, that's the N-word.
That's right,
we do not use. And yet it's casually used as a term because Hubbard came over here and found it, you know, in the 1950s when he came here, it was quite common to look down on anybody whose skin was a different color.
Wow.
And that contempt for the, you know, we are the elite, we are the elect, the electoi, to use the word that the Gnostic Christians used about, you know, people who didn't belong to their cult.
Yeah.
And it is so easy to take that on that, you know, when I first read about Islam and the things like soap, somebody actually tried to argue with me about this in the comments section. Arabs invented soap. And this guy tried to say, no, it was the Romans. And it's no, the Romans used to rub themselves with olive oil and scrape it off. And Romans would actually buy the oil from gladiators so that they could consume it because it would give them superpowers. Very, you know, our civilization is based on the Roman civilization, as we can tell. Saponification, the process of making soap, is, you know, we also have words like alcohol, algebra, algorithm, which show their Arab origin.
Oh, interesting.
Medicine, mathematics, astronomy, and washing came into Europe through the Crusades, through meeting with these people. And the more I read about that and kind of went, you know, we have this contempt for others, this sense that we are the superior people. But in fact, what's happened is that cultures from all over the world, the Chinese, the Persian culture, which is not, you know, was the longest running civilization, even survived Alexander the Great's depredations. It was, you know, Genghis Khan, basically, in the 13th century, really crippled at the Golden Horde. African societies, reading Bruce Chatwin's songlines and realizing how much the Aborigine have to contribute to our understanding of the world, that they see the world in a different and, in some ways, quite beautiful way. Looking at the beliefs of the Cherokee or the Inuit, or wherever you go, you'll find some aspects of genius, some insights into humanity, and this contempt for everybody who's not us, not one of us. I'll use the word as Barack Obama used it. Mongrelization is actually a really good thing, that where cultures meet and share the best they have. We wouldn't have curry to eat, and I went out and had a curry with my delightful wife last night. We wouldn't have that to eat if chilies had not come out of Mexico and found their way to India. You know, and we talk about cultural appropriation. Well, let's stop eating curry then. You know, let's and Thai curries as well, I'm afraid, they got their chilies from the same place. That it is by bringing these elements together, and the same with cults, by letting the walls down, by appreciating that other people too have valuable experience and valuable insight and competencies and skills that may be useful in making the world a better place, rather than a place of constant warfare and hatred and division and divisiveness. Cool. I'm like on a soapbox, aren't I?
No, but I think that's really where the rubber meets the road, and that's why I think it's good to kind of use this as a great analogy to the cultic situation, because we've got so many examples of, you know, war happening throughout our history, and that doesn't mean that there aren't values within those scenarios that teach us about wanting to be a better version of ourselves, whatever, you know, things that we can learn from. It doesn't mean that, you know, we want to embrace war, but, you know, it's this type of thing where there are opportunities to learn from all these type of things. But the more important point is that a cultic group, by creating a warlike scenario, can sell that you're going to gain all these valuable things along the way without recognizing, by putting yourself in that situation, you've usually, you know, diminished you've given your power away. You're kind of not part of the cause, and you've unconsciously come to the point where your critical thinking's been eroded. So you're trying to just help the cause and fight for the cause without allowing you to have your own personal experience of what you're having, you know, in front of you, and being able to say, hold on a second, are we getting a little out of hand here? Is this really what are we really fighting for? What am I really a part of? Do I really believe, like, what they told me I was involved with, versus is this actually working out in actual fact to be consistent with what I supposedly thought I was involved with? Like, seems like what we're doing right now is pretty nasty or pretty debilitating towards others and judgmental and, you know, whatever way you want to put it. And I think that's why it's such a great tool to kind of have as a subject matter to say, listen, if you can't relate to what this experience is, then you're not really, then let's put it in the war format where you can realize the same dynamics are at play. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a great teaching tool from that point of view.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And the point whether you lose the locus of control, the control over your own mind and your own thoughts, where you submit to the group, you know, I think there's, you know, we see sometimes groups that are incredibly positive and achieve great things. If you look at the Clapham sect, who fought against slavery in this country. And they weren't the only people, but they were so determined that this was an evil and it should be stopped, that human beings should not be treated in this way, that human beings, no matter what the Old Testament says, are not chattels, not movable goods. And right, respecting that and understanding that there are human rights and there are lines that we shouldn't cross over. The acceptance of torture at Guantanamo Bay.
Right.
You know, I think everybody should watch the report, the movie, to see how, you know, the report was actually made. 779 people have been incarcerated in Guantanamo Bay. I think there are still about 40 or 50 there. And of those people, 8 were convicted of offences. 5 of those convictions were overturned, which is to say that only 3 actual criminals were found.
Wow.
The methods used...
Out of 779.
Yeah.
Wow.
The methods used were torture and a violation of the Geneva Convention. There is no doubt about that. Waterboarding, so-called, a technique developed by the Spanish Inquisition, is not actually what was being done. They were semi-drowning people. Waterboarding is where you wet a towel over somebody's face and give the illusion of drowning. They were pouring water into people's lungs. One guy was waterboarded 123 times and gave up no information whatsoever. Indeed, despite what Barack Obama said about the capture of Osama bin Laden and the murder, he wasn't tried for anything. The murder of Osama bin Laden. It didn't come about because of information received at Guantanamo Bay, as Barack Obama said. It came from a phone tap. In fact, no valid information has come out of extraordinary rendition and torture. And so when we start allowing these things to happen, then we lose the locus of morality. We become immoral. And it can be just, you know, there's this thing called the Stetson effect, where if somebody starts bragging about the horrors they've committed and you're frightened of them, at least don't smile. At least don't say anything approving. And in life, seek to, where you can and where you feel courageous enough, to stand up and say, I think this is wrong. I find myself in trouble because I disagree with almost everyone. You know, I don't believe in God. I don't not believe in God either. So I'm not a theist and I'm not an atheist. And atheists on this channel have become annoyed with me because I say I'm an agnostic. But I'm an agnostic in religion. I don't know. And frankly, I don't care whether there's a God or not. You know, he doesn't. I don't bother him. He doesn't bother me. We get on fine. I'm not bothered about having an afterlife. I'm not bothered about reincarnation. I'm bothered about the eternal right now. I'm bothered about what I'm doing now, not about what reward I'm going to get, because I don't think I am. I said earlier, virtue is its own punishment. Right. And I don't care. It's the life I'm living and how I'm relating to people and friendship in the world and being able to sign petitions for good causes and speak out against horrors and say, I want people to think for themselves. I want them not only to understand the 128 logical fallacies that perhaps make up critical thinking. That'd be great, but there are a lot of them.
Yeah.
I want them to be able to keep talking about it and not picking up a megaphone and screaming obscenities at people. So, you know, I'm actually on the lookout for people who disagree with me now to go on podcasts where we can have conversations and they can maybe persuade me. And I can maybe persuade them. But that, looking forward, and as you say, that war teaches us that, you know, and natural disasters teach us that we can be humane in the face of horror. And we can carry that on. You know, I think the understanding is that we, as human beings, we are pretty much at war for our own survival all the time, to maintain the homeostasis of the body by not getting too hot or too cold, by, you know, eating enough potato chips or whatever is necessary. I do actually mean at some point to do a serious piece of work on nutrition, because I'm not sure the potato chips are really that good for us. But to be getting food, to be getting companionship, to have meaning in our lives, which I think is, and that is the point where people have to have their herb pillow and they have to have all of these things, that to have a sense of purpose, to have motivation in life. And it's all there to be had. And we live in a society that's way too busy drinking Coca-Cola and crunching, you know, McDonald's fries, liberty fries, freedom fries. You know that after World War One, when the French refused to go into Iraq, French fries became freedom fries and all of that. And I suppose you had freedom dressing as well. That's on your salads. I didn't know this, but during World War One, anything German, so sauerkraut, instead of calling it choucroute as the French do, became liberty cabbage.
Oh, really? I didn't realize that.
Very good for the bowel, you know. What strange creatures we are! But I think we've pondered.
I think we have. I think we have. And I think I think the critical thinking part of it is such a huge component of recognizing these issues, and these subjects are complex and they require critical thinking, and that there is no simple answer, and that, you know, that they're complicated in the nature of, in certain circumstances, there can be positive lessons coming out of things. And then there's also opportunities for incredible abuse and manipulation. So it goes back to things we've talked about in the past, you know, the shades of gray. No, it's not, things aren't black and white out there. And whenever you've got someone telling you they are such, you know, that it is very black and white, and that it is us against them, and that's just the way it is, that should be when a red flag goes up. And I think, you know, discussions like this help educate all of us that we just need to be more vigilant in that area to just not fall into the kind of temptation of oversimplifying something when the reality is they're very complex and complicated, all for our benefit, you know, but it takes more effort and we shouldn't be lazy and we should just, you know, try to put on our thinking cap and try to figure it out to the best we can.
And I think it is a matter of discussion that being willing, you know, and John Stuart Mill's On Liberty, which I repeatedly mention, another of the books that is only about 80 pages long, that and very readable. He was a great writer. But he, you know, in 1850 something, is basically laying out this plan which we should be following, which we should be teaching our children. And we should talk about this another time because I think we're close to the end here.
Yeah.
But I'm not at all sure about the notion of critical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a phrase that doesn't have a meaning. I think we have started to use it instead of using reason or logic.
Oh, I like that. Yeah.
And because, and again, as my friend Christian Churko says, we also have critical emoting. That we have, that the thing that's tricking us is that we ally ourselves to things because we feel sure, because it feels right.
Yes, which is on being certain. The book you directed me towards, which I love, by Burton. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to pluck up courage. I did write to him a year or so back and just say, I'm writing you just to thank you because Skeptic's Guide to the Mind. He was a head of neurology at Mount Zion at the University of California in San Francisco, a brilliant career. And he then is kind of going, this thing that William James says about being certain, we need to check this out. And I think if there's that one first thing that I could share with people, it's that, and I've done videos about it, which have had about 12 views or something, that why are we sure of what we're sure of?
Right.
And finding some truth that we can start from. And for me, that truth is the Hippocratic Oath, which of course doctors don't actually swear. That's one of the myths of our culture. But first, do no harm.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't feel obligated to love everyone because some people are quite unpleasant. But I do feel that we shouldn't be hurting other people. And secondly, that we should seek relationship, seek positive relationship, and seek to ameliorate, to make things better. And on that note...
Yeah, no, I agree. I think we should talk about that. Maybe next time we'll talk about the critical thinking in concert with reason and what that really means. And I also love the idea of the emotional intelligence. Like I think that's a place to really delve into. What is emotional intelligence and how could it be so useful in our lives? And I don't think there's enough focus put upon that to try to create opportunities to allow our young ones and even, you know, our elders to kind of develop some emotional intelligence and what that really means. So that would be fun.
And I think we need to be emotionally intelligent about critical thinking, and we need to do some critical thinking about emotional intelligence, because Daniel Goleman, the man with whom the concept is associated, though I believe John Gottman is really the originator of emotional intelligence, I think Daniel Goleman is not a trustworthy authority.
Oh, interesting.
His last book is written with a Tibetan Rinpoche master. And is telling us, just as Jon Kabat-Zinn has said, that simply by meditating, we will become compassionate. When Harvard professors are telling us nonsense, we need to think critically about how intelligent their emotions are, I think.
Oh, that does sound like a good conversation to have.
Good. We're going to have fun. This has been, as always, enlightening and discussion. If when we talk about things, we have to think about them, and we realize that maybe we don't know enough about them. I don't know enough about anything yet.
I'm with you on that one. Yeah.
Great pleasure.
Always a treat to see you, John. Always. Yeah. I look forward to the next time.
Great. Thanks so much, Troy.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hi, John here. Thanks for watching. We'd appreciate it very much if you would click like, as well as subscribe and click the bell for notifications. Every dollar helps, and we welcome new patrons on Patreon, or you can make a one-off payment with any currency through PayPal. Thanks so much.